This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Joel C. Dekwa, who's a threat intelligence manager at NTT Security.
Hello, my name is Joel Cederhjö. I work as the threat intelligence manager for NTT Security in Gothenburg, Sweden.
People think they understand a lot about threat intelligence, but they think it's just about large amounts of data being given to them that they can then do something with. It's much more complicated, isn't it?
Definitely is. Right now we're in the process of trying to rename my team away from threat intelligence. It's a very big problem for us that threat intelligence has been a very big buzzword over the last few years, and to very many people it means completely different things. So when I say I work with threat intelligence, it creates a very big dissonance in what people expect. For me, threat intelligence is all about how can we enhance our threat detection services. When we work in the SOC, we focus very much on that everything we produce has to be actionable. We don't create large amounts of big lists that nobody looks through. We don't write write-ups about a very specific attacker that no one will ever meet or be faced with. We're only focusing on what can we use.
So how do you refine that down? Because if we look at the number of lines of information you get, the number of alerts that generates, the number of attacks that potentially identifies, by the time you then continue to cook that down to what you just called actionable intelligence, what does that mean that the customer gets?
For the customer, the value that our services bring is that the customer gets a report that details what have we found, but also in essence, what do we recommend that you should do now? If we send an incident report to the customer and we'll tell them, hey, we found something here, and then we attach the CV of the attacker, but we don't say anything about what should you do now, then that is useless for the customer because they still have to do their own investigation. They still have to have detailed, very skilled people who can then themselves find that out. So when we say actionable intelligence, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to attach the passport photo of the attacker, but we should also try to say, this is what you need to know now to go forward.
That's quite important for a lot of organizations. They lack a lot of skills. They have plenty of people in IT who know how to do stuff, but they don't necessarily know how to trace an attack. They don't have the skills to work out what that attack is doing to their system.
Sure.
How many of your customers expect more than that? For example, a script to run on their system, or even just a written script that they can follow step by step by step?
We have customers from all different maturity levels, and most often it's not always all about the maturity level, but also about the size of the company. So you can have a very mature company that is quite small, and they don't need that kind of playbook. On the other hand, you can have a very big company that is also potentially very mature, but they need that kind of playbook recommendation style because they themselves, for example, the CERT team that we communicate with, they themselves need to take that incident report and send it off to help desk or to local IT teams. It all depends on the setup of the customer and the setup of what they need at the moment. It can vary very much, but I guess it's about 50-50 need a playbook type recommendation and the others kind of wing it.
When you take all that information that comes into you to get to this actionable intelligence, what sort of processes do you do? Is it just pure data analytics? Are you looking more deeply into it to identify where you can who launched the attack? Or are you looking for things like what exactly is the attack targeting? Is it trying to shut down a system? Is it trying to steal data?
For my team, most of the time, we spend a lot of time, first of all, making sure that we know what's going on. That means reading all the blogs, following the trends, making sure that we're following the right people on Twitter, and we know what attacks are going on. The second step is to translate that into our environment and the customers that we protect, and to understand, all right, so let's say, for example, WannaCry. Then we need to know, okay, our customers have vendor X, Y, and Z. Do we know if these vendors are protected? Do we know if these vendors have protection in place? Do we know when they will publish that? And if not, then it's our job to make sure that we can apply the detection capabilities or the protections that our client needs to know or pay us for, basically, to cover that gap. That is most of the time that we spend.
It's interesting when I walk around a lot of security operations centers and I talk to threat intelligence teams, people tell me it's hard to attract talent.
Sure.
Because a lot of the job is about the granularity, the nitty-gritty. Listening to you explaining it, they're sitting down, reading blogs, looking for information on the web. Almost sounds like a dream job to a lot of people in that way.
Sure. I think for a lot of people, this is a very attractive job, but I don't think a lot of people even know it exists. but it also can be a very hard job. You have to be self-motivating, because one of the things when you're working with analytics, you're working with problem-solving type activity, 99% you're going to hit your head against the wall, or you're going to spend an hour reading into something and then, oh, it was for nothing. We can't use this information. It can be a very tiresome work to always try to push yourself forward. And not everyone is built for that.
How hard is it to find people who want to do this?
It depends on what your capabilities are from the beginning. If you have unlimited money and unlimited resources, then you can pay the best people to come from wherever they are right now. Of course, you need to balance that with your location and the job you have and the resources you have available. But for us, we have been quite successful in finding younger talent who have this as a hobby. They spend a lot of time maybe just reading on blogs, they're programming at home, they have it as an interest. We've found people who are studying to become nurses and didn't know that IT security was a field they could get into, but they were playing CTFs in their spare time. And we found just a number of different people that through various channels.
I find the nurse story quite interesting. I heard that the other day when I was talking to other people at NTT. There's a perception, again, around security operations centers and security teams, that it's very geeky. It's lots of young men sat there with hoodies over their head being antisocial. And therefore, it's become incredibly hard to get a better balance. And this is not just a balance in terms of gender equality, but a cultural balance as well, to understand why one type of attack appeals to a specific group of people. What do we need to do to widen our recruitment, and how do we make it more attractive to people?
The business in a lot of ways are changing a little bit. So for example, in Sweden, last few years, there's been a big focus on these work preparing education. So instead of going 5 years at university studying to be an engineer, for example, they have these 1 year, 2 year courses where you can very quickly get into the IT security business. But also I think the business is moving into accepting people from different backgrounds within IT. So for example, you can have a sysadmin moving into IT security, you can have a network engineer, you can have different PMs or whatever moving into, because they have the right mentality. For example, when we hire people here, we do have technical tests, we have different types of knowledge that you require as a bare minimum. When we do our tests, we instead try to focus on, if we give you this piece of information, what would you Google for? How would you find out if this is a good thing or a bad thing? And depending on what they ask in return or how they approach the information that we give them, that tells us much more about, is this person something that can become an IT security professional?
Problem-solving skills are incredibly difficult to find out early on when you're talking to somebody in an interview. When we think about testing people, how do you find out how good somebody is about problem-solving during that recruitment process?
When we're doing the recruitment process, we do it in different layers. The first interview we have, we talk about very specific skills. We ask them, for example, about different equations. We ask them about Linux distributions or how different operating systems work. But we also tie in some questions about calculations, algorithms, etc. The second part of the interview is when we give them a sample log that might come from a network device. And then we ask them, please find out what this is from. Then we let them think and we help them by saying, well, if we tell you that Google would say this is X, how would you take that in? What does that tell you? And then we try to simulate working in an environment that is as real as possible. Then we try to gauge how good are they, basically.
It's also a job, isn't it, where shift work becomes part of the challenge for people. And when we think about shift work, we might think about nursing, but for most people, they tend to think about an industrial type environment. And shift working can be tough. It's not so much the early or late shift, but it's the night shift, it's the disruption to family patterns. How hard is that then to attract people in their 30s or 40s or people with families? Because they come with some very interesting skills that they can apply to solving the problems, but it may not appeal to them.
That is definitely correct, and it's a challenge for us, for sure. Usually the people who work the shift work are younger people. They don't have families, they don't have hobbies that might require them to be available only during daytime. We have had some success in attracting people who are more willing to work night shift, for example. The way we approach shift work is also that we have a rotation where you only work night shift for a few weeks, and then you work daytime or afternoon, and then you have some flex time, so you work between 9 to 5. But most of the time when people work flex time, we don't require them to be in at a specific time. For example, if you work night shift for 4 weeks, we don't want to force someone to get in at 6 a.m. That's just horrible management. We allow them some flexibility in terms of when do you wake up, as long as you come in and we don't have anything big going on, come in at 10, come in at 9, just as long as you do your hours, then we're good.
You're one of several teams inside Entity Security doing threat intelligence. How much collaboration is there between the teams, or do you tend to take responsibility for problem and call in skills when you need it?
It depends on the threat and what the situation is. For my team, we are responsible for making sure that the detection capabilities for threats that are up and coming are present in the detection capabilities we have out for our clients. Things like writing a public bulletin or doing press releases, for example, we will leave to other team within Entity Security. We will only focus on the need to solve this problem right now to help our clients.
When you're solving the problems, it's easy to get lost sometimes in the details of a problem. Clients don't necessarily want all the detail. How difficult can it be to abstract yourself from the granularity of the problem to say to the client, look, it's only three things you've got to do, whereas you've just spent 20 hours trying to work those three things out?
That's something that you need to learn to live with. We can spend weeks or months researching a threat, talking to a threat actor or researching a threat actor, understanding exactly what they're doing, their tools, the techniques, and then we send a super cool report to the customer and they said, oh, we scanned the computer, we found nothing, close it. That can be very frustrating sometimes. But that's part of the job as well. My job is part to be a technical account manager, so I'm still working very closely with some of our larger clients to help them understand our incident reports, help them understand what are we doing, how to help them get better at utilizing our services. It is a challenge, but most of the time, as we work with clients and we have a more mature collaboration, the client get the trust from us that, oh, we scanned the computer, we found nothing, then we really need to investigate because then something is wrong. Entity usually don't send us false information.
When it comes to using tools, if we look at the bad actors out there, they have access to a vast library of tools, many of them now available as a service. When you look at the tools you have here, you've built many of these yourselves in order to be able to speed up the process. How difficult is it for new people coming in to get to grips with the tooling?
Most of the time, they get caught on quite quickly because we hire a quite specific profile, the problem solvers. When you're a child, you can learn a language quite easily. We don't hire children, but we hire people in early 20s, maybe 30s. So they are quite fast at picking up these things. But it all depends on, of course, how advanced their role is and what they're expected to do.
So what specifically have you had to build that you couldn't have bought off the shelf?
Most of our time is spent building integrations between different systems. For example, if we're doing certain investigations, we have to spend time making sure that we're storing it correctly, and then we're categorizing and tagging that information correctly. But then also, how do we make sure that that happens to end up at a customer blacklist or in the customer device? It's a lot of trial and error sometimes to build detection capabilities that fits a certain vendor device. Most of the time is spent doing that.
The battle between the bad actors and your teams can sometimes get incredibly complicated. They have access collaboratively to vast pools of people, and we see a lot of collaboration on the dark web. How frustrating can it be sometimes trying to compete with somebody who seems to have limitless resources?
It can be quite frustrating, but you can also see it as very rewarding when you do find ways to track them down or to create something that will reliably find their activity every time. I think especially now, as you described, where it's an ecosystem in the dark web where different threat actors are sharing data with each other, they're sharing methodologies, they're sharing infrastructures, that creates a very, very difficult net to entangle. On the other hand, it creates a very good opportunity for us where if we have great detection for group A and B, and all of a sudden group C begins collaboration with them and sharing infrastructure, sharing tools, there's a ripple effect on the work that we have already done for group A and B, where we can also then detect group C. Yes, it definitely adds a layer of complexity, but it also adds more reward for our hard work when we have done a good job.
Does it sometimes get to be where you want to just put photos up of the adversary on the wall?
I usually try to not focus that much on the, here's the passport photo of this guy. It's similar to when you talk about mass murderers or a school shooting. You don't want to put so much hype on the person. You want to put a focus on the activity and how you can stop that activity. Of course, it can be interesting on a very, very final point of your investigation when you maybe involve law enforcement and do takedowns. But if you're counting the big takedowns around the world, it's been a handful over the last 10 years. If you talk with big newspapers, that's the coolest thing. Like, do you know exactly who did this? Maybe not, but we have a very, very good understanding of how they are doing this, what they are doing, and how we can protect our customers. And at the end of the day, usually that's what our customers are interested in.
One of the advantages you have is you're doing all that detailed research, which from a police perspective is great. It gives them evidentiary data they can work with. When you hand a playbook to a client, the last thing in their mind is save the evidence. It's save the business. How complicated does that make your job in terms of providing something to both sides? Because the police want to be able to trace this through. The client doesn't really care. They just want to be up and running. And you're kind of caught in the middle.
Usually we have already sent the data we have to a client. And if the client then wants to press charges or bring that forward, they can do that completely independently. We don't involve ourselves in that. And then if they need our help with that, then we can assist with the data that we have. We very seldomly our own contact with law enforcement or take that route, then that's completely separate.
And that leads me to the obvious next question. If we look at the lack of resources for the police, they don't have the forensic cyber capabilities. Is there an increased interest from their side on you taking over and doing the forensics? And does that lead to greater interest internally in getting forensically aware people?
I can't say that I have noticed a greater increase from questions for help. In our SOC, we have a lot of people who are very driven. We want people who are always a bit of healthy paranoia in terms of they always want to find out the cause for things. And as the attackers or the adversaries are getting more advanced, then we are also forced to be more advanced to enhance our detection capabilities. That leads to an interest for our team to be more forensically aware, to push themselves to the next level in terms of understanding what is going on. Because if you're looking at, for example, 5 years ago, the detection capabilities we have for some exploit kits, for example, were very, very rudimentary. However, it worked perfectly fine. It was a URL string, 16 characters, black hole. Very, very easy. But it worked very, very well for many years. Now you have some infection vectors, you have honeypots, the waterhole attacks can be incredibly hard to detect. However, that also stimulates the analyst brains that they need to push themselves. They need to find new techniques to simulate being a victim.
So if somebody came up to you at a school fair or a university fair and said, look, I'm interested in this, what should I focus on?
I would start by questioning, why are you interested in this? What are your entry points? What is it about IT security or threat intelligence that spikes that interest? For me, for example, I'm very interested in the geopolitical aspect of threat intelligence, where you have different threat actor groups, even if it's not a nation state, but it's all these different entanglements that provide into the IT security field. Apart from, of course, I enjoy IT security. I think that's really great. But on the other hand, you can have a person who likes reverse engineering, or a person that they love big graphs, so they enjoy the data science part of it. It's not necessarily that you need to be an expert on everything, but I think it's important to understand what is your driving force to get into this business, and then work on that and try to fit in for yourself. Create yourself the role that you need, or that the companies might not know exists. There are only so many job ads, but if you can search any job and then go there and say, this is what I'm really good at, then they will maybe be, oh, we really need this, and they will create a job for you.
Joel, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.